Okay, we need to start to get this started on time. Our speaker is Dr. Richard Sherlock. Incorrectly, it says in the program that he is a professor of philosophy at University of Knoxville, of which he says that's a non-existent university. He's really the assistant professor of human values and ethics at the University of Tennessee, the Center for Health Sciences, and graduate of Harvard Divinity School or the Harvard University, and a contributor to Sunstone on a number of occasions.
You can't hear
back there. Okay, well, these guys will speak louder, I'm sure. A couple of very excellent articles of his have been printed in Sunstone, one that will be out today. So watch for it from last year's symposium.
You can introduce Bob later.
Yes.
She's right. University of Knoxville does not exist. The University of Tennessee Center for Health Sciences is 400 miles away from Knoxville. It creates some problems for the university. But the main campus of the university is 400 miles away from the medical complex, medical school, and other health science services. This paper, I'll just preface this by saying, this paper was for me a very difficult paper to write. Not because I had to speak to a general audience. Those of us who teach in medical schools do that as a matter of course. It was a difficult paper because it forced me to think about some very basic differences between a religious, and in this case specifically Mormon, outlook on both life and afterlife, and the view that is common in our society, and as I argue in this paper, is necessarily presupposed by our society, namely a secular view that allows people to believe what they want on these sorts of matters. It seems to me, as I hope that you'll pick up from the paper, there's some very basic tensions there about life and its meaning that reflect themselves in moral choice and which lead to some, I think, very, very tough conflicts between what we would all think might be acceptable in Mormon terms and what is certainly unacceptable for society at large. Enough of the introduction. Joe is 83. He has lived a long and useful life and has done his best to do his duty to his country, his church, and his family. He has raised 4 children and has 10 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. 3 years ago, Joe had a massive stroke which left him totally paralyzed on one side of his body and partially paralyzed on the other. He is now almost totally bedridden. Moreover, his speech was drastically impaired, and he can now communicate only very briefly and with difficulty, mostly in the form of grunts and groans. The neurologist believes that brain damage did occur, and doubt exists as to whether Joe is really aware of what he is trying to say. Many of you may have seen friends, relatives in this position. His family is doing their best to care for him, but in his condition, that is difficult and time-consuming. Most importantly, they have begun to ask the question of what really does constitute care for Joe. In Joe's condition, repeated infections are a certainty. Before the advent of antibiotics after World War II, Joe almost certainly would have died in a very short period of time. Maybe some of you, especially some of you who are older than I, remember the well-known aphorism that pneumonia was the old man's friend. And Joe, before the advent of antibiotics, almost certainly would have died of that or a similar infection, you know, in a very brief period of time, months at the most. Today, the situation is different. Joe's family can go to great lengths to keep him alive. When he gets pneumonia, they can fill him with antibiotics. If he has trouble with feeding, he can get his nutrition with an NG tube through his nose and down into the stomach, and they can pump liquid sustenance in it. If he has trouble with feeding, he can get his nutrition with an NG tube. If he has trouble with normal elimination, surgical procedures can be done and bags attached. All this just to keep Joe alive. Little Mary is about as different from Joe as you can get. She was born 3 hours ago as the first child of concerned and caring parents. They were anxiously awaiting her arrival and had the adorable nursery all prepared. Something went wrong in Mary's development. She has been born with spina bifida and accompanying myelomeningocele in the upper lumbar area of the spine. Briefly, this is a break in the spinal cord and the formation of a sac at the point of the separation. If surgery is not done within 48 hours of birth, Mary will, in all likelihood, die within a few days. With surgery, she will most probably, almost certainly, live, but she will also certainly be severely handicapped, both physically and mentally. My poor artwork demonstrates what the situation is. There's children are born with a break in the spinal cord. There's the formation of a large sac on the back. You see the child, and it has this large lump sac. This membrane here, this skin here, is very, very thin. It breaks, it drains, it creates infection. The child dies. You have to surgically cut that open, drain it, and repair it so that it runs straight across. The likelihood that she will be severely retarded is high. Even higher is the probability that she will be confined to a wheelchair and will have bladder and bowel incontinence. Further, it is almost certain that Mary will need further surgery in the future. In the relevant medical literature, it is not unusual to find reports of 10 or more surgical procedures performed on such a patient before age 20. I have recently read one in which a girl was born with this condition, has since graduated from college, but had in the interim 26 separate operations before age 20. Clearly, Mary's parents, like Joe's family, have some very hard thinking to do. Unlike Joe's family, they have to decide right now, in the next 24 hours, whether to go ahead with the surgery. But just like Joe's family, if they choose to forego the accepted therapy, they have chosen death over life for a loved one. Is it right that they should even consider such a choice? Isn't life always preferable to death? And shouldn't we choose accordingly? An answer that some of our people in society would say. Considered solely on Mormon grounds, the only proper answer to that question is no. Consider for a moment the situation of little Mary. She is to be kept alive, saved, if you will, in a state in which she will almost certainly never be close to normal in her intellectual functioning or physical abilities. Her capacities for growth, for learning, for self-improvement, all of the reasons for which we believe she came into this life will be severely impaired, if not non-existent. And they would be even further impaired if we added what is often the case with children in this condition, that they have an accompanying condition known as hydrocephalus, the enlarged head with water up here, where you have to run a tube up into the brain, essentially, and drain water off. And children born with that have even more severe retardation. And frequently the child has this condition and that condition combined. Consider for a moment little Mary. She is to be kept alive in this state, in which never even close to normal in her intellectual function or physical abilities, her capacities for growth, for learning, for self-improvement, all the reasons for which we believe she came into this life will be severely impaired, if not non-existent. Joseph Smith taught clearly that life hereafter, in any of its various stages, is so much better than our life now that were we to experience it, we would never wish to remain here. If we really do believe such a view, then why would we even consider forcing the burden of a suffering existence here on this child? Would it not be a far greater expression of our love to let Mary pass from this life now to obtain what we believe is a far better existence elsewhere? And if one really gets into the doctrinal discussion of three degrees of glory and the fact that Mary's an infant, you know, one can extrapolate for oneself a much stronger argument at that point. Consider further the family of Mary or Joe. The individual who requires chronic care places a great strain on his or her family, and it will simply not do to ignore such strains with often trite nonsense about the opportunities this gives for learning true charity. It does do that in some cases. But families do break up. Parents do suffer emotional breakdowns. Siblings do grow resentful and even hateful at the time, energy, and resources devoted to one family member at what they perceive is their expense. We who value families and family stability so much ought to think twice before we reject actions that seek to relieve family burdens and strengthen the abilities of families to cope with an already difficult world. This argument, I think, is simple and compelling. It is, however, too simple and too compelling. In its simplicity, we are apt to overlook the broader implications of the policies it would lead us to endorse. And at the outset, we may be convinced to follow a path that would lead logically to conclusions that none of us could in good conscience accept. In order to understand the deeper issues at stake in the debate over these and other cases in which the term euthanasia is often used, we must address some of these hidden implications. Only on this basis will we be able to give a comprehensive answer to the questions posed by these cases. It is important to recognize, however, that these deeper implications do not necessarily follow from Mormon doctrine, which on its own terms, I believe, leads to the conclusion noted above. If we are going to think seriously about these matters, we are going to have to transcend the narrow confines of a religious morality, which most of us have rightly been conditioned to accept. Of course, this is not the only such case in which our religious concepts may be in tension with secular views, or in tension with what we think society ought to do, or in tension with, or incapable of answering questions that we did not even know how to ask a few years ago. But it is an important test case for creative ethical reflection beyond mere obeisance to authority. The most critical question in the argument sketched above is easily grasped once we stop to think about it. How bad is bad enough? Any family that would fail to treat Mary must judge that the life that she would have is bad enough. Or in slightly more elegant terms, they must judge that she will have a life not worth living. Surely, however, we do not want to approve of parents making such a judgment for any reason or no reason at all. Nor do we want physicians to aid and support parents in any such decisions that they may make. For example, I do not think we want to permit parents to seek Laetril or herbal therapies for a disease like acute lymphocytic leukemia, where the long-term survival rate with accepted therapy is substantially better than 50% with early onset cases. For a child under 2 who comes down with acute lymphocytic leukemia and accepts accepted therapy, the chances of that child being alive 5 or 10 years from now are substantially better than 50%. And I don't think any of us want to say that parents ought, in that situation, suffer no penalty for going to Mexico and getting the latest Laetril. The only way in which we could, I think, approve of such a withdrawal of therapy is when the judgment is made that the life in question isn't worth living anymore. Only when such a judgment is made is it even coherent to think of death as better than life. This question, however, remains unanswered. How bad is bad enough? What are the characteristics by which we will mark off that class of individuals whose families are to be released from their normal obligations to support their members and provide or consent to life-saving medical treatment for them? Who should be allowed to die when their lives could have been saved with appropriate intervention? Is this a decision any of us is prepared to make fairly, without personal whim or prejudice, ultimately deciding the question? Would we be satisfied with our conclusions, such that we would be willing to apply them to others in society to determine if they, too, have a life not worth living? These are difficult questions. Perhaps the best way to see the difficulty of rendering this kind of judgment is to consider the currently fashionable notion of death with dignity. As it stands, this phrase is much too vague to provide any guidance for physicians and families. Try in your own mind, however, as you sit here, to formulate some specific ideas, some specific criteria that would delineate with reasonable precision. Obviously, you can't, every case you can't fit in, but with reasonable precision, just what kinds of lives would lack dignity and should therefore be allowed to die by withholding medical treatment that would otherwise save lives. Is it not obvious that when we try to do this, most of us are thrown back on very personal hopes, feelings, desires, and in some cases, yes, prejudices? Yet I doubt seriously that any of us would really wish to see social policy of this magnitude based on nothing more than the feelings or prejudices of those designing and implementing the policies. Is it really the case that any of us is so wise that we can safely allow him or her the freedom to decide that some human lives no longer merit the most minimal protections that we usually accord to all other human beings, no matter what their condition or status in life? The Mormon experience of persecution for such things as communitarian economics and polygamous marriages reveals something of the same pretension to knowledge. What was it that was really so threatening to liberal society that it should have marshaled such strenuous efforts against polygamy? From the long view of 100 years, the answer must be that very little, if anything, justified that effort. Yet at the time, many otherwise intelligent, respected, and supposedly responsible people believed passionately that the most unique features of the Mormon system were utterly incompatible with liberal government and Christian civilization, and hence must be suppressed, ruthlessly if necessary, by that government. The point is simply that human beings often think that they know what they do not. They believe that certain things are ultimately worthwhile, or ultimately disastrous, or ultimately incompatible, when in fact none of these things are true. Human beings are finite, limited in their capacities for empathy, judgment, justice, and wisdom. As mortal men and women, we now see only through a glass darkly, and even in the most spiritual light, we are often unable to see the way ahead with perfect clarity and to decide fairly and justly how to proceed with our lives. This fact of human life has not escaped the attention of thoughtful men. From ancient times to the present, political philosophers, religious leaders, and practical statesmen have wrestled with the great questions of justice, virtue, and political rule in light of their knowledge of human weaknesses and propensities. How can we create political regimes and legal mechanisms in such a manner as to minimize the effects of such propensities, while at the same time giving a wide scope to human liberty, which we all cherish, and a nurturing hand to human virtue? To put it in other terms, how can we give practical substance to our convictions about the value of human freedom and our knowledge of the human tendency to abuse that freedom through claims concerning knowledge that human beings do not in fact possess? In modern times, this compromise has been reached in liberal regimes by a political abstraction from any claim to a knowledge of what is ultimately worthwhile or worthless in life. Governments like ours, like the one in which we find ourselves, posit as the first principle on which they are founded a rejection of any assertion that they know anything more about man than that he is a physiological entity of a certain sort with certain biological needs and an ability to pursue distant ends, sometimes to the detriment of others. And if you look around, I think you'll see that that is the basis on which we form our government. We don't say we're going to adopt the Mormon view of life, or the Catholic view, or the Jewish view. We're going to adopt a view that everybody subscribes to, namely that we're basically just physiological entities and we have needs for food, clothing, shelter, basically physiological sorts of needs. Now, of course, we need an education and we need a job, but why? In order to provide for those things. Not because it's in our eternal interest, you know, to learn things, but because you've got to know something to get a job so you can keep body and soul together. As a matter of law and politics, governments like ours reject any knowledge of the highest and lowest possibilities of human life. They do this in favor of a regime that protects basic rights of everyone alike, and then gives them the liberty to define the ultimate good for themselves and pursue it in their own manner. In accepting the above compromise, liberal regimes pose both an opportunity and a problem for Mormons. Like our contemporaries, we too are committed to nurturing and defending human freedom. We do not wish to force others to live according to our standards any more than we would wish to be forced to live according to theirs. Yet Mormonism does not presume the ignorance about human perfection that our contemporaries accept, and it does not suppose that we are limited to human knowledge alone when we are faced with difficult choices. We live not for the body, but rather for that most illiberal of things, the perfection of the soul. And we hope not for a better or perfected democracy, but a transformed world in which he whose right it is to rule runs essentially a one-man show. It may seem paradoxical but true, therefore, that we Mormons have been ardent supporters of this liberal, pluralistic, and democratic society. This is a fact which cannot be ascribed to accident or ignorance. Perhaps subconsciously we have recognized that even though the gospel flourishes in many different societies, the church as an institution, a gospel as a personal belief, is very hard to suppress. But a church as an institution can be suppressed rather easily, as we've found out once before in our history. Church as an institution seems to flourish only in those societies that protect the minimal rights of every person equally. The church flourishes where its freedom to pursue its goals and ends is protected on the grounds that entail a similar protection for persons and groups that have aims, beliefs, and lifestyles that we neither support nor find admirable. A government that could enforce our view of the good life would also be a government powerful enough to enforce someone else's view. And it takes very little knowledge of scriptural history, human history, together to remind us how often the admirable traits of one ruler give way to the despicable qualities of others. Our compromise with political liberalism thus represents a realization of the nearly inevitable tendencies of actual life in the world. Not as we wish it was, but as we in fact face it in a less than ideal world. Understanding these propensities, as for example King Mosiah did, we are willing to minimize their potential for mischief by supporting a society that is less than what we hope for, but is worthy of our support as one in which the church itself can flourish. These previous paragraphs may have seemed a bit digressive, but they were not. It is essential that we understand this kind of context in which the issues of Mary and Joe present themselves. If we do not, we may be convinced simply by the argument that we began with. Looking at it from this broader context, it becomes more dubious. It may be appealing to decide not to treat Mary or Joe. If we do so, however, we must realize that we do so out of our convictions about what awaits them elsewhere. We must also grant that same freedom, if we do that, to others who hold no such beliefs about the afterlife and who believe that they will be getting a far greater reward, but who simply want them dead. Furthermore, if we decide not to treat these individuals because we believe that they have a life not worth living, we must grant to others the right to make such judgments in far less appealing cases. For example, would any of us believe, you may think this is debatable, a lot of people do, but would any of us believe that if the only thing wrong with Mary were that she had Down syndrome, we should refuse treatment and let her die? The older term for that was mongolism, but that has obviously racist connotations, and most professionals are trying to let that term die a death. Yet, considering this Down syndrome situation, there are parents who have in fact done just that, with the acquiescence and even in some cases support of the physicians involved. It's withheld, accepted treatment, and the Down syndrome baby dies. Further, let us note that while Mary is just a few hours old, there are others who have the life that she is supposedly to be spared by declining treatment. Should we then offer this same course of action, which is supposedly so good, to the hundreds of thousands of children in our institutions for the retarded? Those who believe that Mary and Joe should not be treated ask for the freedom to decide that for some human beings, the normal presumptions concerning respect for and saving of life should not apply. The most minimal right which we are all said to have, the right to have our physical existence secured against the actions of others, is here to be set aside. In other words, these beings do not even possess the most primitive of rights with which we as a society presuppose all human beings to be endowed. Lacking any consensus about the kinds of cases in which this right ought to be set aside, contemporary writers in many fields, philosophy, medicine, law, religion, hundreds and hundreds of articles, have given us a hopelessly confusing mass of advice. Consider, for example, just the question of what to do with infants like Mary. Some writers have claimed that infants who lack the cognitive and affective ability to relate to others, that's a quote, ought not to be saved. Of course, they never tell us how much or how little of these abilities is required, since if the level is set even modestly high, we wind up with frightening advice about what to do with serious illness among our severely retarded population, and if even the smallest amount qualifies, then the policy is self-defeating, since the only neonates that would qualify are anencephalic, that is, no brain, not even a minimal brain, a condition which is incompatible with the maintenance of life anyway. Others have focused on the presence of severe retardation, with no attention to what this might mean if fairly applied to all other retarded persons, nor with any rationale beyond claims about burdensomeness, which are themselves circular, about why we should consider retardation so crucial. Furthermore, they usually give us little useful information about how much retardation would need to be present for a newborn to be allowed to die. Still, other writers have focused on the presence of multiple handicaps, such as non-ambulation, bowel incontinence, blindness, and or retardation, without, of course, telling us what relation any of these handicaps has with a life not worth living, nor with confronting what such a policy would mean if fairly applied to all handicapped persons. Aside, the leading article in the medical literature that came out 9 years ago, a massive English study conducted by a man named Lorber, concluded that he had a rating scale that could tell you, based on various factors, most significantly where this break was exactly in the spinal cord, how large the sac was, whether or not there was accompanying hydrocephalus, and he created a more or less scorecard that could tell you what the child would be like given that condition at birth, that precise version of this problem at birth. And he concluded that the most significant thing was the physical handicap involved, the severe physical handicap, unable to walk, confined to a wheelchair, bladder and bowel incontinence, and that the fact that that would happen was enough for him to say, we shouldn't treat this child and we should let it die at birth. The vagueness and confusion in these proposals is obvious. Their, what I consider uselessness as substantive public and medical policy is even more apparent. The truth is that these and countless other similar proposals would commit us to courses of action in relevantly similar situations that none of us would ever wish to endorse. We are asked to reject some of our most basic convictions concerning the appropriate course of action to follow with the debilitated, the deformed, and the handicapped. Death, not better care, is what we are asked to endorse for these human beings, and this only in the name of vague claims about suffering and family burdens. As a society, it seems to me the thought of acting on these claims is both frightening and somewhat preposterous. The confusing and contradictory nature of the claims made in these proposals is not unexpected. In fact, the differences they represent are the price we pay for the great pluralism that a free society like ours fosters. Yet this very freedom renders it highly unlikely that we can ever reach fair decisions on such a momentous and highly personal question as when, if ever, there is a life not worth living. To permit this choice to be made in a society like ours is to permit an almost unlimited array of possible choices for death over life. If we permit the refusal of treatment for Mary, we will inevitably be forced to permit such refusal in numerous other cases, many far less disabled than she, and we will be logically committed to a policy that would permit such refusal in cases involving hundreds of thousands of severely handicapped individuals. If we say Mary's parents ought to be allowed to make this decision based on their family situations, we may trust ourselves to make that decision. We may know somebody else we would trust to make that decision. But in a free society, you can't do that. You say, all parents will make this decision. And some parents are going to make some bad decisions. Are just going to want some kids dead. Considered solely as a public and medical policy in a secular society, I believe that this view is sound. Nevertheless, it must be remembered that it follows from the distinctly un-Mormon premises on which this society is based. This is a tension that I do not think we can ultimately resolve satisfactorily. Of course, it is surely prudent for us to doubt that anyone can have, in a definitive fashion, the kind of knowledge he would need in order to decide that a given life is not worth living. It is also a matter of prudence that we generally obey those rules that exist for the benefit of society as a whole, whether or not we specifically would stand to benefit from them. These, however, are merely generalities. They are useful as guides, but they may not work in every case. To be sure, the scriptures do give us examples of families that bear strenuous burdens with noble courage and patience. We do admire these examples, and we should seek to emulate them. But we are all not like Job or Lehi. Given this fact, it does not seem to me impossible to suggest, on purely Mormon grounds now, that a family might be certain that death is preferable to life at a certain point. Consider Job, for example. it seems to me entirely reasonable for a family to decide that he has done everything he can with his life. He has lived it as well as he could, and now it is time for him to go. Once this decision is made, I think the rest comes easily, but not without a lot of anguish on the part of the family. If they have decided that his release from this life should not be prolonged, then I think that intravenous antibiotics should not be used the next time he spikes a fever. Meaning, in effect, that we will let the pneumonia or whatever be the old man's friend in this case. And certainly no other resuscitative measures should be employed. I also have some doubts about continued feeding with an NG tube, if you've seen people, you know, lying there with severe stroke. On purely Mormon grounds, belief in an afterlife, it seems to me, alters how one perceives that situation very drastically. Mary, it seems to me, is in a much different situation. In her case, or in the case of most abnormal infants, far too much is unknown to make any very accurate prediction of what her or his future will be like. We simply cannot say with any assurance what their future capacities will be, what they will be able to do, to think, to say, except in a few very rare syndromes. Most of them will not be in frequent or continuous pain, and in the most severely retarded cases, their mental status makes it unlikely that they will suffer. The man I was telling you about just a minute ago, this massive British study that made the claim about physical handicaps and bowel incontinence, his claim was that the reason why this was so bad was the suffering involved. Because the children may not be mentally too bad off, but they will suffer because they know, they're intelligent enough to know what's happening to them. It seems to me that that's something that can be alleviated in other ways than what he seems to think. Paradoxically, as one moves up the scale toward normal, suffering increases as a result of the greater awareness of difference on the part of the handicapped person. But no one is suggesting that mildly retarded people have lives not worth living. What life will bring for Mary, we cannot know with any certainty. But she can have a life free from overwhelming pain and suffering. And I submit, it's a personal statement, but that for her is enough. That she can have a life of meaning and purpose, limited though these may be. Given the imponderables in her future, I do not see how we can choose at this point not to give her life and sustenance and care, to enable her to do with her life what Joe has already done with his, make the best of what she has. Let us remember, however, that those who seek to let their children, like Mary, die, and the physicians who counsel them to do this, do so for the most humane of motives. They wish to eliminate the sometimes crushing burdens on the family and the suffering that the child will have to endure in life. But these are problems that we exacerbate by our unwillingness to bear one another's burdens. And if you've had any associations I have with institutions for the retarded, you see families who just cannot take it anymore because they don't get any help in the community, and they show up there, you know, just wanting to dump their kids and leave them and run. But these are problems we exacerbate by our unwillingness to bear one another's burdens, even in these difficult circumstances. When we refuse to help these families with the load that they have to bear, we drive them and others like them to believe that death is better than life, than the lives that their children will lead. Perhaps we need to remember that the Lord has suffered long for us, and that we are, in a sense, beggars after his mercy. If we did this, then we might not be so ready to desert these families in their hour of need. Only, I think, when we do that, will we give people reason not to choose death over life during this life. Thank you.
We'll now hear a response to the topic by Dr. Robert Fowles, who's a graduate of Harvard Medical School and presently a practicing physician and a professor at Stanford Medical School.
I'd like to thank Richard for what I thought was a very lucid paper, which was I think obviously difficult for him to write because of the things that he mentioned. I would like to respond very very briefly to allow some discussion, which I'm sure should be entertained from the floor. But in responding, I'd like to respond as a physician rather than as a Mormon or as a moralist or as any sort of theologian, if you'll permit the term. The reason I want to do that is that the physicians have been taking it on the chin recently in the press and in many arenas because of the new medicine to which Richard referred. I think that we have to look at doctors in the way that we deal with our own illness and with our own perception of life. But many people tend to view doctors as either priest monks who live in an ivory tower, aloof from worldly concerns, vowing certain things such as secrecy and devotion and dedication. Whereas in more recent times, we tend to see doctors more as plumbers and technicians who do valve jobs when you need something done for your heart or who can fix something if it goes wrong. Now, both of these are extreme viewpoints, but in any case, I feel more like a plumber today because it seems that we expect the plumbers to fix the pipes, but we don't expect them to discuss the theory of hydraulics or why water goes where when it does or why what pressure and flow means. And that's exactly one of the problems that physicians have today. The new medicine has imposed many problems upon the medical community. Now, the new medicine has produced a new technological offspring called the new doctor. And there are many new things about life in the medical world now that we have to bear in mind as we consider these ethical dilemmas. One of them is that we don't die at home anymore. Now we die in the hospital. It used to be that Dr. Jones would come out to the house and hold Granddad's hand while he spiked a fever, and he'd either resolve the pneumonia or he would go away, and the doctor was there more as a friend of the family than as an intervening power. The new technology has created devices which now can prolong life, but I hesitate to ever use the word artificial because what was once extraordinary has now become commonplace, and what is one at once not now able to be envisioned will one day become reality. For example, what we think of now as a simple penicillin pill was once an extraordinary and experimental form of therapy. And when patients were given penicillin, it was such a valuable commodity that their urine was collected, the penicillin taken out of the urine and then readministered over and over because of the fact that it was such a rare new agent. At one time, pacemakers were felt to be a tremendously artificial mechanism for prolonging life, but that's not at all the case now. They're very commonplace. And it's not a grotesque form of or artifact. What may be held for the future in the way of transplants or artificial organs are things that we have to consider as well. Now, there's another problem with dealing with ethical dilemmas with regard to dying and death, and that is that life expectancy is being manipulated a bit, but it's not being extended. And what I mean is that in former years, as people approach 100 years of age, from birth, a certain percentage of them would start to die off, and by the time we reached 100, most people would be dead. Due to modern medicine, however, these survival curves are now being rectangularized, so that more and more people are now living, and then all of a sudden they're going to die. And as we approach the coming decades, we'll find that we don't have a burgeoning population of doting, senile, burdensome people on our hands, but that we have more and more a population of active, productive, senior people who are not ill, but that who will eventually die merely because of a biologic clock that's inside all of us that says that we will probably not live much longer than 100 years. And so this is this rectangularization of life expectancy curves as much on the minds of physicians nowadays. The other thing that I'd like to point out is that the healing cult has been very strongly demystified. what was once thought of to be the province solely of doctors who had gone through some sort of mystical fraternity initiation in years of arduous medical school, which was thought merely to be fooling around with dead bodies and taking oaths, has now become much demystified, probably mainly due to attorneys who, due to their excessive litigation, have taken the secret realm of doctors into the courtroom. It's also been demystified by legislators. And we happen to have with us in this session today Senator Wallace F. Bennett, who enacted PSRO legislation by which medical peers review the conduct of other peers. And these things now become public. And then we are able to examine and turn over why doctors are doing what they're doing. The chiropractic lobby is now very strong in America. And so chiropractors are able to do now what once the priest-monk physician did. Not to mention acupuncturists and holistic health medicine specialists and herbalists and spiritual healers and almost anybody else who is humanely or otherwise motivated. And with this new medicine, the new MD has begun to withdraw from the realm of assertiveness, and he now is seeking an escape from some of these ethical dilemmas. An example is for something that for most of you would be familiar, resuscitation of people who've had a cardiac arrest. When a person drops on the golf course or something and is picked up by the paramedics and brought to the emergency room, the first question that is always asked by the nurses or by the physicians is, how long ago did the patient drop? Because obviously if his heart has stopped a certain amount of time, the brain will be dead. And someone has fixed a certain period of time, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 3.5 minutes, as a way of determining whether the brain will live or not. Physicians tend to use this as an escape. When a paramedic says resuscitation was not started until 15 minutes after the patient dropped, the chances that that patient will be resuscitated as much as a person who dropped earlier are much, much less. And we must not kid ourselves, because passive euthanasia goes on to a great extent, and it has always gone on. It is only now more public and more demystified. So physicians tend to use such things as the 3-minute rule to escape from a moral decision. And we can't fault them necessarily, because we as a populace tend to escape from moral decisions. And Richard brought out the point that our liberal regime does the same by denying that there is any ultimate good or any ultimate virtue, and that freedom and agency should reign supreme in order to allow the individual to decide. But if we are to take part in the human scene, we can't abandon this decision-making. We cannot say we aren't going to make decisions, because if we do that, we're automatically making a decision by default. And we may simply, by withholding treatment or by allowing treatment, make a decision the same as if we had by not making any attempt to decide or to agonize over the situation. The motives for establishing guidelines for treatment of the very ill newborn or for treatment of the very ill aged person have been brought about because of the ubiquity of these situations. They go on every day. They become more commonplace now that we have the new medicine. And people feel a pressure and an urge to discuss these problems and to open a dialogue and to simply comfort one another, if nothing more. Certainly physicians do that. I know that. Richard also mentioned that one of the reasons for establishing guidelines has been said to be to protect against abuse. We can protect against the abuse of some arbitrary physician deciding to pull a plug by creating guidelines and legislating, perhaps, with a scorecard, or probably more realistically now, perhaps a computerized algorithm for deciding whether a person should live or die. And it has been stated by many writers in the field that one day there may be death boards in the hospitals. We now have come through a period of time when abortions were such a controversial issue that there had to be an abortion board to decide whether an abortion would take place or not. In the future, there may be death boards. These boards deciding in an ultimate fashion when someone will finally be allowed to die and these artificial means of support will be withdrawn. But only then could that be done. And that may well be one of the logical extensions of the situation that we now find ourselves in. One of the problems with the guideline system, as Richard brought out, is that it tends to be vague. But as I've felt very strongly in his paper, he brought out quite well the fact that these guidelines naturally tend to either lead to a trivial solution or to an absurd solution. For example, in the anencephalic infant, no one would probably argue with the fact that that infant should not be treated, and most of them are not going to do very well anyway. And so the guidelines would allow us to make that decision, but we would have done that anyway, and so the dilemma there is trivial. On the other hand, as Richard brought out, if we choose to allow such an infant as this to die, then by logical extension, we doom hundreds of thousands of other people who are in mental hospitals and in psychiatric wards to the same fate, and the solution then becomes absurd. So either trivial or absurd is the dilemma of the guideline makers, and I sense that very deeply in dealing with that. The only problem that I have with what Richard is saying is that I don't know whether I can agree with what I would call the domino theory of logical extension of these ideas. That is, that supposing that we permit the discontinuation of therapy, are we then logically extending this throughout society? De facto, we aren't now, because these things are still in the hands of the priest monks. But if we systematically permit such things, I agree with Richard that a domino theory would ensue, in which by induction everybody would be under the same problem. Now, to sum up, I'd like to just mention that I felt that we might look at the problem with anti-dysthenesia, or being against an unnatural death, much as we might look against other moral dilemmas. For example, transplant. How can we look upon the transplantation of organs or the implantation of artificial organs with the same clarity that Richard's brought out in this problem of dying? The extraordinariness of the therapy has become not an issue anymore, because now it is probably accepted medical practice to transplant corneas, kidneys, hearts, and soon lungs and livers. And so the ethical dilemmas will hinge upon many things, and that is whether we should allow doctors to wholesale go ahead and transplant anybody who is sick enough, or whether there should be some sort of psychological or ethical guidelines. And then the problem comes up, where do we get the donors, and what will be the ethics of that? In California, we can sign the back of our driver's license. And if we do that, then when we are in an automobile accident, the hospital can take our organs for use in people who might need them. Many people have told me that they're reluctant to sign that card. At the same time, in the intensive care unit setting, many people have told me that they're reluctant to bring up the aspect of transplantation, because they're afraid that the physician or the priest monk will withdraw some of the therapy and be less likely to be aggressive in treating the patient if there's a possibility that the organs may be salvaged. I don't think that this is a problem, but it's a problem in the minds of the populace. Now, in conclusion, I'd just like to thank Richard for two things, mainly for bringing out the test case aspect. As Peggy mentioned in her address this morning, the reflective aspect of our religious life and our theology is something which probably enriches us and makes us better people. And I think that using this test case is a valuable way to look at our own way of handling our religion, because of the fact that, as he pointed out in his paper, these problems did not exist 50 years ago, and of course they didn't exist 5,000 years ago. Because we didn't have respirators, we didn't have pacemakers, we didn't have many of the surgical techniques, excuse me, such as transplantation. It seems to me that the ways of dealing with these ethical dilemmas have been touted in the press as being fourfold. One being the absolutist policy, in which no one tampers with life, no one plays God, God has a divine monopoly over life, and we should neither practice birth control nor death control. The second is sort of an existential cop-out, or what might be called stoic indifference, in which life is viewed as no more worthwhile than death, and so what if? The third being a pragmatic situation ethic, in which each situation is its own standard. Life life's value therefore becomes only valuable when judged against the surroundings. But it seems to me that as Richard Paper intimates, and as we all live, the LDS view adds a fourth one, and that is this element of revelation and inspiration. And many of us who are Mormons would expect our physicians or whoever is dealing with us to, our families or whoever may be making these decisions, to attempt to receive some sort of inspiration or revelation. And this may be this may be comforting to Mormons, but it certainly isn't to legislators or lawyers. I'd like to also comment that as I deal with Mormon friends and with Mormon patients, I find Mormons quite liberal in their view toward anti-dysthenesia or euthanasia, and actually quite conservative in their views towards transplantation. They tend to be a little bit less pro-transplantation, thinking of it as an artificial thing, something that if Dad's got a bad heart, so what? We're not going to do something weird to him to make him live a few more years. And at the same time, they tend to be more pro-euthanasia. He's lived a good life, and after all, Joseph Smith said that we'd leap to the next life if we could see it. And the babies, they'll be saved anyway if they die before 8. We tend to be actually quite pro-euthanasia when you look at it. And this point was brought out by Richard. So we need this creative reflection in order to keep ourselves in the world and to do some reality testing. So this is a good test case. The second thing and last thing I'd like to thank Richard for is his invocation or his injunction to us to bear one another's burdens when it comes to these decision-making processes. Elizabeth Kubler Ross, with her revolutionary and pioneering look at death and dying, has merely stated that we need to be closer to our dying people, to share their burdens, and to share the burden of grief with one another more, and that's the ultimate solution towards helping out a bit more. And I think that that is the solution toward many of these ethical dilemmas. Thank you.
We have about 5 minutes for questions. Yes.
I'd like to take exception to the idea that this is a modern dilemma. I think that historically and ecologically you can say that certain migrating tribes, for example, have a way of letting their old people know that it's time to hang back and not move with the tribe and thus make a decision. I think that the idea is easier in a homogenous society, in a tribal society, than it is in our world at large. But I wanted to ask the question, in view of the fact that there are religious groups that have certain ideas about life preservation, blood transfusion, and so forth, is there a possibility that our Mormon ethos could be applied? Do we have to have a society in which every decision is made at a common level? Could we not, as our own society, proposed solutions which would apply to Mormons that could be applied in the same way that Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, use blood transfusion?
I'm not going to answer.
You ask an interesting question. The bottom line is that I don't think it's possible to create, in many of these situations, a sufficiently basic view other than the one that I tried to state in the paper that everyone would be predisposed to accept, particularly when you're speaking of infants. Jehovah's Witness case is interesting. We normally think of respecting the Jehovah's Witness, the adult case, but we normally do not like to think that the Jehovah's Witness parent has a right to make that choice for his child. And yet, as I tried to suggest in the paper, on Mormon grounds, on uniquely Mormon grounds, where we're talking about inspiration and revelation, you get a different picture. Let me just ask a question. You don't need to answer this. It's just for your own reflection to try and make more clearly the point that I tried to make in the paper. How many of you, with an infant like this, would trust President Kimball to make a decision to let this child die? I think most of us would say probably yes. How many of us would trust Jimmy Carter to make the same decision? I don't know. It's not a political statement. I mean, Carter's a decent man. I don't abstract from that. What I say is, that puts the point that I'm trying to suggest.
Question, who would trust their position to make that decision?
Who would trust your position to make that decision? Even if he were a member of the church.
Right.
And you trusted him as a church member as well as his position. Yes. I think that's interesting. The problem with that is that while it may be my decision, in many cases, particularly with children and folks like Joe, they can't make a decision. Somebody else has to make decisions for them. Somebody else has to impose a judgment of what they believe is best for this person. And that creates the real problem of formulating guidelines. I agree with you. If it was only left up to us, we might be able to get away with that. But I think we need guidelines when we're talking about, you know, letting me decide for Bob here when he gets wrecked up in the auto accident, or his wife deciding, or somebody else saying, well, I really think that Bob would want this. Well, I don't know.
I'm the priest, I'm the plumber.
No time. I'm sorry, no time.
We have to go on.
I'll discuss with anybody privately, anybody that wants to.